Is counsel being willing to change its schedule so we can hear the cases today? We have five cases on the calendar today. Case from the Court of Federal Claims, two patent cases, one from the District Court, one from PTO, which is submitted on the briefs and will not be argued. We've got a trademark case from the PTO and an employee case from the Merit Systems Protection Board covering most of the spectrum of our jurisdiction. Our first case is J. Anthony Dobbins versus the United States, 2015, 5020, 21, 2017, 12, 14, Mr. Hawker.
May it please the court. We're going to talk about initially the good faith and fair dealing duty. The trial court began its analysis in this case by recognizing that the good faith and fair dealing duty may not be used to craft a better deal than the parties made for themselves. It does not create an amorphous companion contract with latent provisions that modify the parties' agreement. But then the court went ahead and did exactly that. We have a 4.5-page settlement agreement. It's at Appendix 330 through 334. That's what I'm going to talk about today. And going through the introductory and 13 substantive paragraphs, nowhere in the agreement does it impose any kind of obligation on the part of the government along the lines of what the trial court imposed upon the government in this case. In fact, in dealing with a direct breach claim, the trial court found that certain ATF policies, guidance documents, were not included in the contract, could not be the basis for an express breach finding. But after having done that, the court looked really to what the nature of the grievances were that led to the contract to conclude that Mr. Dobbins was concerned about having some protection and safety beyond that he experienced that led to the grievances in the settlement agreement.
The trial court said this was a story of demonstrated misfeasance, failure of ATF officials to abide with the spirit of a contract.
And the spirit of the contract, what is the contract? Contract states what its spirit was in the very first paragraph, the preliminary paragraph, which says that the contract was to fully resolve and settle any and all issues and disputes arising out of Mr. Dobbins' employment. And then it lists the various grievances that Mr. Dobbins had. But nowhere in this contract, in the 4.5 pages, does the agency take on any responsibilities other than those that are typical of a contract resolving an employee grievance. We can go through them all. Paragraph one, they provide a retroactive promotion. Paragraph two, they agree to his request to be sent back to Tucson. And as part of that, they agree that to the extent they need to move him in the future, they will confer with him, which was one of his grievances ahead of time when they were moving him to California and to D.C. They didn't really confer with him or allow him to have input in that process.
And there was an agreement to pay $373,000.
Exactly.
That was paid, right?
That was paid. Then we go and there was issues in the case below about Mr. Dobbins engaging in public discourse concerning some of the very interesting aspects of his employment. The agency agreed to not pursue discipline and to later on agree to deal with outside employment and speaking opportunities and consistent with agency regulations. We go on and on through all the expungement of the records. All of these things are very standard provisions that are in settlement agreements that we entered into all the time with our employees. The key four paragraphs I want to talk about this morning are at the end, 10, 11, 12, and 13. Beginning with 10. This was the subject of the trial court's breach analysis, but it's also very relevant to the good faith and fair dealing question. 10 is the provision we've seen before, that the agreement does not constitute an admission by the agency or Mr. Dobbins of any violation of law or rule or wrongful act or omission, and that the agency will agree to comply with all laws regarding or otherwise affecting the employee's employment by the agency. Now, at the trial, there was a discussion about what does that mean vis-a-vis these ATF orders. And the trial judge, in our mind, correctly held that the ATF orders are not included in the contract for effectively two reasons. One, the juxtaposition between sentence one and sentence two in paragraph 10 leads one to conclude that laws, in the second sentence, does not include agency policies and guidelines. It's not a law. We point out, although it wasn't available to the trial court at the time, that that's consistent with Supreme Court's decision in McLean, although that case was dealing with a statute, has the same effect here when reading a contract. Moreover, the trial court indicated that to the extent there was any ambiguity in the contract, and at various times the trial court seemed to suggest there might be, they allowed Mr. Dobbins to put on parole evidence over our objections. But as the trial court found as a factual matter, the parole evidence couldn't establish that any of these ATF orders were actually envisioned by the parties to be included in the contract. I think Mr. Dobbins thought that they were, but the government folks involved did not. So at the end of the...
Mr. Hockey, yeah. I may be jumping ahead a little bit, but it does deal with paragraph 10, which is obviously a critical paragraph. Request for admission 12 and your response to request for admission 12 seems to me to at least open the door potentially to an argument that paragraph 10 is acknowledged by the government to import a requirement of safety. And I'm particularly directing your attention to the question. The request is that did ATF have an obligation to protect the physical safety of plaintiff? And the answer that you gave is admits to the extent that the obligation identified in the request pursuant to the language of paragraph 10 is established by statute, regulation, or ATF order. It sounds like that is an admission.
There was some.
It's somewhat tortured language, perhaps, but does open the door to saying this is acknowledgement that the order had a role to play.
My first response is it's really, as we explain in our briefs, we don't view it as an admission. And to the extent that we responded the way we did, I think we explained in our briefs the basis for doing so. At the time, the court was suggesting to the parties that at that time the laws could include this type of thing.
But you were resisting that position. It would have seemed to me to be wise to write an admission that at least acknowledged that that wasn't your position, because I'm not sure why this admission, if it is taken as an admission that you, in fact, agree that you have an obligation to protect safety under paragraph 10, why that doesn't override the position you were taking legally as to the meaning of the paragraph.
I think as we explained, Your Honor, we're operating within the framework of the existing direction from the court at the time, and we were being very careful in identifying the fact that, our position is that they're not laws. This is a matter of interpretation for the contract, and that that not only do you have the McLean argument, but you have the folks that actually did the negotiating say during the trial that that's not what was envisioned by the parties. That instead, what we're talking about here were more standard employment laws, to include things like, for example,
Mr. Hockey, you can use your time as you see fit. But you're a third of the way through your time, and you haven't mentioned the point of your main appeal, the breach of good faith and fair dealing.
Right. Well, I mean, but anticipating that to the extent we are successful on that, Mr. Dobbins is going to try to take a shot at the paragraph 10 holding. So, but the paragraph, yeah, to respond to the other aspect about paragraph 10,
What page of the appendix is this on?
333. It goes from 332 to 333. Straddles those two pages. The settlement agreement. Another aspect about paragraph 10, which has some.
I meant the admission.
The admission is on 1992 to 1993. In volume 2.
But to go back, are we still talking about it? I was going to continue with the discussion on good faith and fair dealing, Judge Bryson, unless you want me to continue. That the agency will agree to comply with all laws regarding or otherwise affecting the employee's employment by the agency. What's not often focused on in this case, but Not only is there an idea here suggested by Mr. Dobbins that there's an obligation on the part of the government to perform these duties, but enveloped within that idea is the idea that the remedy for such an alleged breach would be the contract. In other words, that an agent or an employee for the federal government who otherwise is bound by statutory and regulatory procedures with respect to remedying his rights through like the Civil Service Reform Act and similar statutes and regulations can bring a breach of contract at the Court of Federal Claims under the Tucker Act. And this court has recognized that although it is possible to bring a settlement, a breach of contract under a settlement agreement, referencing Holmes and Cunningham, the idea is not to litigate grievances, which is what this case is trying to do. What we're trying to do is to litigate grievances that took place after the settlement agreement, under the idea that they were somehow anticipated in the settlement agreement. But there's nothing in the settlement agreement that imposes the obligations at issue. They might be very well new grievances, but those grievances should be handled the way every grievance should be handled, through the normal statutorily available processes. Paragraph 11, the parties agree that the terms of the agreement are unique to the facts and circumstances, and that the agreement may not be used as a basis by either party seeking or justifying similar terms in any subsequent case. That's also a provision that we tend to see a lot, and perhaps the court has as well. Here, frankly, looking at this provision, especially the second sentence, one has to ask oneself, why have a statement in the document which says that if there's a similar case in the future, that that you can't use this agreement as a basis to obtain similar relief? If, to the extent there is a similar case in the future and the parties anticipated that that would be handled under this existing contract, one would think that the second sentence of paragraph 11 wouldn't be necessary. So that there's an argument there that, frankly, under the language of this court's good faith and fair dealing cases, including Metcalf, you have a provision which arguably counsels against reading this as a basis to use as a breach for future grievances that Mr. Dobbins might have with the agency. Paragraph 12, obviously, the integration clause, basically saying that to the extent you have parole evidence or other types of evidence that alter or attempt to alter the plain meaning of this document, which would, I think, still, you can argue about admissions, but if we're talking about what does the plain language of this document say, plain language of the document says what it is, and any change to that language requires a written modification, which is not present in this case. Paragraph 13 is your standard paragraph regarding what happens if there is a considered breach of the contract, and that, in this case, as is often the case, the remedy is to go back and either ask for, like if the payment didn't happen, ask for the payment to happen, or otherwise you can restart your case that led you down this road. Taking all of this together, and including those prior paragraphs which we just touched upon about what the obligations were, nowhere in this document, in this 4.5-page document, do you have obligations of the sort that Mr. Dobbins suggests should be placed on the government. I mean, there's a question about, clearly the agency has Mr. Dobbins' safety and protection at heart just because he's an employee. The question here isn't that. The question here is, does this document provide Mr. Dobbins with any other type of right that isn't enjoyed by any other type of agent? And our position is no. This document is simply a resolution of a grievance. And when we have grievances, there's various ways you can resolve them.
Not sure that's a fair characterization of his position. It seems to me what he's saying is he has those rights that are enjoyed by others, not additional rights, but his position, I think, is that because you didn't follow, as he sees it, the orders that you would have followed in other people's cases, that he was deprived of the same rights that others would have, and that this contract gave him those rights.
So, paragraph 10 seems to be the back door into how you get there, but all that says is I will provide you the same rights as everybody else. And frankly, if there's a violation of those rights, then one would presume that vindication of that violation would follow the typical remedial scheme provided by Congress and not one provided by contract, unless there's some really expressed language which would overcome the concerns raised by Fausto and Elgin and this court's decisions in Bobula and Cunningham about litigating what are really agency grievances before the Court of Appeals or before the Court of Federal Claims under a Tucker Act theory. The statutory remedy is available.
That all makes sense, but the problem is that you included this provision in the agreement about compliance with laws, which would seem to give him some rights under the agreement if there was a violation of a law, right?
We would suggest that to the extent the court were to read this contract in that language to impose upon the government an entirely different type of relationship with Mr. Dobbins, then that would require some heavy lifting, some express language. It's not something that could simply be implied into the paragraph 10 language, which simply says that the government will comply with all laws regarding or otherwise affecting the employee's employment.
So what did he get from that sentence that he didn't already have in the form of a grievance?
He may not have gotten anything in the sense of an extra reward or something, but that language is generally put, well, it's often put in, and I don't know what led it here. The testimony indicates that there were folks from counsel's office who added some language into the contract, including the two folks testify that may be what that language came from. But generally, it's an idea that after you sign the contract, we're not going to terminate you or take some other sort of adverse action. But again, if something like that were to happen.
If they terminated him, would his remedy be to proceed to the MSPB, or would his remedy be to proceed on a breach of contract?
We would argue that his remedy under Fausto and those cases would be to proceed through the statutory available processes.
And even if this sentence had read, and we won't terminate you for at least 2 years for any cause, would he then have an action under the contract? Or would he still have to go to challenge the termination on the basis that it was unjustified?
That's a more difficult question where there's an actually expressed promise to take or not take a particular action that might be inconsistent with the law. In other words, if the agency under the law had every right to terminate Mr. Dobbins for something,
but it promised in a contract that it would not,
then that may present a different question. We don't have that here. All we just have is this reference to the laws.
Mr. Hockley, you wanted to save 10 minutes for rebuttal. You've got about 3.5 left. Do you want to save that?
3.5 for my total rebuttal?
Yes.
I thought we had 10 minutes each, or maybe I did speak.
Am I reading this wrong?
All right, we're good? All right, so I need to save that for my rebuttal?
Yes.
Then I'm going to save it for my rebuttal.
Mr. Reed.
Good morning, Your Honors. James Reed for Plaintiff Cross Appellant J. Anthony Dobbins. May it please the Court. Before I start, and as a reciprocity here with my colleague, Mr. Hockey, we did have an order from the Court allowing 20 minutes per side.
Mr. Hockey started with 20 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
You were starting with 20 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. This is, fortunately, for a variety of reasons, not a typical Federal Circuit appeal. Following a three-week trial with 29 witnesses, Mr. Dobbins proved that the government violated the covenant of good faith and fair dealing in a 2007 settlement agreement, which the Court has already discussed with Mr. Hockey. That settlement agreement resolved, among other complaints, an EEO claim protesting ATF's mismanagement and non-responsiveness to years of death and violence threats. Included within the EEO claim was a standard Form 95 emotional distress damages statement. Deputy Director Ronald Carter was ATF's negotiator. Under our trial court's North Star housing decision, the government speaks with one voice. And therefore, in our opinion, Mr. Carter was the government in those negotiations. All of the relevant trial testimony confirmed that the settlement agreement was for one purpose, the protection and safety of Mr. Dobbins. As context, and the Enron decision says context, context, context in interpreting a contract, in 2004 and 2005, ATF conducted risk assessments and concluded that extreme risks of threat of death and violence to Mr. Dobbins existed. ATF testified at trial, multiple agents, that threats from international crime syndicates such as the Hells Angels, the Aryan Brotherhood, and MS-13 never expire. A 2007 limited threat assessment conducted only over a three-day period did not find new threats but concluded that the prior critical risks remained. Now, Mr. Dobbins had two kinds of undercover fictitious identifications. The first were approximately 20 protection and safety IDs and a few remaining undercover IDs. The protection and safety IDs were to disguise the Dobbins family vehicles, their utility billing, their tax records, and most importantly, the location of their residence.
But was there a breach of an express provision of the agreement?
Your Honor, of course, the trial court found that there was a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
But not a breach of the contract.
The trial court found that there was not a breach of an express term of the contract. And our first, the main argument that the trial court made, which I would reiterate, is that the withdrawal of both the covert undercover mission IDs along with the William and Sasha Johnson fictitious IDs recklessly endangered the family. But because, Judge Lurie, you bring it up, I'll go right ahead to our position we advanced in the brief, is that there should have been a finding of an expressed, a breach of an express term of the contract. We argue that ATF orders were encompassed within paragraph 10 of the settlement.
That couldn't support the judgment, could it?
Excuse me, sir?
That could not support the judgment, could it?
Well, the judgment was an award of $173,000 in emotional distress damages. Our position is that as long as the contract is breached, whether through the spirit of the contract and therefore a breach of the covenant or through an express term of the contract.
But if you were going to try to sustain the judgment on the basis of the violation of the orders, you'd have to tie the orders into what the government did and say that the government breached the orders. That wasn't done by Judge Allegra when he wrote this opinion. He did not tie the violations that he found to be violations of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing to any violation of the orders, right?
That is correct, Judge Sykes. We're saying that Judge Allegra erred in that regard. We are saying, and we advanced it in our briefs, that there is plentiful case, there's a plentiful trial record through the report of investigation, October 11, 2012, and May 10, 2013, by Internal Affairs Division at ATF, that found that multiple ATF orders were violated.
But I don't think you're answering my question. My question is, how could we possibly, even if we were to agree with you that laws included orders, and even if we were to agree that that provided a theory for breach of contract, this judgment couldn't be sustained on that basis because it's not based on a violation of the orders, right?
Your Honor, it's based on a violation of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. You're correct, Your Honor. However, I would respectfully submit that if this court were to find, unlike Judge Allegra, that ATF orders are encompassed within the word all laws in paragraph 10, which in the second sentence, which is the prospective compliance obligation, as opposed to the first sentence of paragraph 10, which is the disclaimer by ATF. If this court were to find, were to determine on a de novo review that orders are inside the two words all laws in paragraph 10, as under Rule 36, the Department of Justice conceded, and as Judge Bryson correctly indicated, in RFA response number 12, but it goes right through 18, the Department of Justice specifically concedes in their Rule 36 responses that ATF orders 3040.1A and 0.2A are both contained within paragraph 10. We would submit, Your Honor, that as long as you find that on de novo review, Judge Allegra should have found that ATF orders were in paragraph 10, you have an independent and sufficient ground to affirm the award of $173,000.
I simply do not understand that, since he never tied the amount of damages to the alleged violation of these orders.
Your Honor, Judge Allegra tied the damages in two manners. And by the way, the record, and we're talking about emotional distress damages, so I'll point out that the record includes Dr. Todd Linneman's testimony and the Department of Justice's expert, Dr. Kevin Leahy. Basically, both of the psychologists and psychiatrists agreed that Mr. Dobbins had extreme emotional distress based on ATF's abandonment of him and then their pursuit of him as the arson suspect for years after the two top arson agents in Arizona cleared him. Now, there is nothing unique about the covenant versus finding a breach of the contract through paragraph 10, a violation of ATF orders, because the fulcrum violation are the orders contained in Special Agent Trainor's IAD report on the withdrawal of the covert IDs, in which he listed a good 4 or 5 ATF orders that were violated, and in his October 11th, 2012 report of investigation regarding ATF's arson response to the August 10, 2008 arson, he listed another half dozen to 10 ATF orders that were violated.
Okay, could I ask you a question about
of course,
the
Your Honor.
60B motion? I'm not sure that I understand the theory of why, in order to claim sanctions, to seek sanctions, you would have to set aside the judgment. Isn't it the case that even after a final judgment has been entered, that the court would still have the authority to impose sanctions for misconduct during the case?
Well, Your Honor, of course, you're referring to our cross appeal to continue the remand proceedings under Rule 60B. And our, you know, the fact is that the judgment is entered. The matter is closed in the trial court. The purpose of...
But you're not answering my question. My question is, why do you need to set aside the judgment, which you like, in order to get sanctions? Can't you, even after a final judgment is entered, can't you seek sanctions?
Not in the newly assigned trial judge's opinion, Your Honor. And that was exactly the reason that Judge Allegra issued his December 1, 2014 indicative ruling. He felt he no longer had jurisdiction to do that. Now, his indicative ruling was limited just to the misconduct proceedings, and he did not want to reopen the $173,000 award or those underlying findings. And this court, in December of 2014, sent a limited remand back to the trial court to allow us to pursue depositions, discovery, and an evidentiary hearing with the opportunity for my client to seek sanctions or at least to have an additional award, ground for damages, attorney's fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. As the briefs indicate, we discovered a ream of emails that suggested, and this is distasteful for me to point out, I'm sure it's awkward to hear, but there were a number of emails discussing a threat against our witness, Christopher Trainor, by the government's witness. The same day he got the threat, he found his SUV, his government vehicle, had been vandalized. We don't know what the government's role was in that impermissible contact, but we do know through a ream of emails that the trial attorneys kept it from us and kept it from the judge. Judge Allegra felt the integrity of his courtroom had been violated, and he allowed Agent Dobbins and I to return to the trial court to find out what happened and to satisfy ourselves with an application for sanctions if the evidence fit and made that appropriate.
The sanctions request that you made, you're implicit and actually explicit as well, I think, in your brief, is that these sanctions, if imposed, would be issued in your favor. That is to say, you would get whatever monetary sanctions were issued. Why would that be the case if what we're talking about is, for example, attorney misconduct that did not affect the judgment as such, but may have been conduct that was sanctionable by the judge? Why wouldn't that be a sanction which the judge would impose on the attorney, but not in your favor?
And Your Honor, I understand that it very well could be. We don't know the shape or form that motion for sanctions.
I'm hard pressed to know why that would, in any circumstance, lead to a judgment in your favor if you weren't able to show there were additional damages above and beyond the damages that you've already presented evidence on.
For two reasons, Your Honor. Under the law of the jury verdict method in calculating emotional distress damages, when you come up with that number, it has a lot to do with the egregiousness of the government's conduct. If we had found out during the third week of trial that our witness had been threatened, that the government had retained that information, or if they just turned it over right away, that our witness had been contacted and threatened, we would have been able, Your Honor, may I say it differently? We don't know how Christopher Trainor might have been more effective, more aggressive, more assertive in his testimony in painting the government.
You're not trying to reopen the damages award. You say specifically that you're not asking to reopen the damages award, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what are we talking about here? Did you make a motion for sanctions in the district court? In the Court of Federal Claims?
Your Honor, we had not yet because we had just finished the written discovery. We were scheduling depositions. We had them scheduled once already. Then they were
continued. So there was no request for sanctions?
Your Honor, the proceedings were terminated.
Just answer.
Yes, sir. There was no request for sanctions made. The proceedings terminated too quickly. And Judge Sykes, if I may, the point here is to simply replicate the order of remand that this court issued almost 4 years ago to the day. This court in December 2014 said that the trial court will keep the award in place, the findings in place, and this is for a limited remand purpose to investigate the scope of proceedings that Judge Allegra described in his December 1, 2014 indicative ruling. So we did this once already. It's just that the moment Judge Allegra retired, very tragically, the trial court terminated the proceedings and did so after we had gotten the emails that, in our perspective, almost sealed the deal. And we felt either we're going to have an additional ground under the Equal Access to Justice Act for attorney's fees, or we were going to have sanctions. And if they were directed into the court's funds, all right, that's fine. But in the end, we feel this case stands for something a little more than money, and Judge Allegra trusted us to get to the bottom of it. Your Honors, there are a couple of points in particular I would like to make if I can, and then I'd like to reserve some time. Can I proceed?
Please proceed.
All right. On the issue of orders and laws as the second point, Judge Allegra engaged in a linguistic exercise, which I thoroughly appreciate, but we differ with somewhat. Judge Allegra indicated that we did not harmonize the use of the word law between sentence one and sentence two of paragraph 10. However, I would point out to the court that in the first sentence, the disclaimer sentence, the word order does not appear. Now, the Department of Justice in their Rule 36 admissions states that in paragraph 10, orders are there, and they specifically say it's within the words all laws. Now, as we know, law is a collective noun. It is a term of art in this industry. It's not the equivalent of a statute. It's not the equivalent of an order. It's also not a rule or regulation, which are specifically denominated in sentence one. And so in the second sentence, the government has agreed that the word order is inside all laws. And certainly, ATF did not intend for possible violations of ATF orders to be outside the scope of the disclaimers in sentence one. So the only place in this linguistic exercise that the word order can be to harmonize the Rule 36 admissions, to harmonize the use of law across those two sentences, is inside the word law, along with statutes. We would contend that this is a reasonable, contextual, logical interpretation of law, and it's one that should be followed.
Now, Mr. Reed, the question of what these admissions really mean seems to me, in reading the language, for example, of request number 12 in the admission,
yes, sir.
The government says it admits to the extent that the obligation is established by statute, regulation, or ATF order, which is really kind of circular. It seems to me it says nothing more, at least if you read it on its face, than we admit that the obligation is established to the extent that it's established. So why does it say any more than that?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that's not the only one. There are six RFA responses.
I know, but I think they all have essentially the same structure.
Except, this, Your Honor, with all due respect, the second sentence, and this is at Appendix 1990 and 1991, RFA response number 5, because we've selected RFA response 5 and then 12 through 18 sequentially. The second sentence of RFA 5, again, Appendix 1990-91, ATF Order 3040.1A and ATF Order 3040.2A provide the agency's guidelines and procedures for reporting, investigating, evaluating, and handling threats of violence and intimidation made against agents or family members of agents.
Yes, but this isn't tied, for request number 5, isn't tied to the contract. That's merely saying that it has an obligation to protect agents, which it has admitted as late as Mr. Hockey's opening argument that it does. That doesn't go to whether the contract provides for any specific remedy.
Yes, Your Honor, but that's the turnkey definition. Because in in the second sentence of RFA response number 5, it says this is the purpose of 3040.1, 3040.2A. They are essentially the 3000 series of ATF orders. In RFA responses 12 through 18, it then goes on to describe all of the kinds of things that are inside paragraph 10. And once you link response RFA number 5 to 12 through 10, then you have the complete puzzle finished. It's a two-step process, Your Honor.
Mr. Reed, you wanted to save 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that'll only be on the cross appeal.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, then that's what I'll do. Thank you.
You may continue. Use it.
I think I'll use the rest for Rule 60. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Hawker, you have...
May I please record? I have 4 things to say and 3.5 minutes to do it. First one, having had a moment to compare the 5 through 11 versus 12 through 18, I think our position in our briefs and is first bunch talk generally, not with respect to the settlement argument, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the ATF orders here. And the second group have the phrase that we intentionally put in there pursuant to the language of paragraph 10, which is our way of saying to the extent the court makes a finding that it's included, well, then it's included. But our position here throughout, and frankly why we went and litigated this case forever and are appearing before this court now, is that it's not included.
Yeah, it would have been a lot easier just to say that.
Yeah, sorry. It's a large appendix.
No, I mean, it would have been easier in the admission.
Right, yeah.
Just to say, sometimes, no, we don't admit it.
To borrow the
usual default position in admissions, isn't it?
The second thing I want to mention briefly.
Do you agree that in order to seek sanctions in the context of this case, there was no need for a Rule 60B motion?
I would respond this way, Your Honor, which is not responsive, but the only item before this court is the Rule 60 motion. And as the record demonstrates, including Mr. Dobbin's briefs, Mr. Dobbin isn't seeking relief under Rule 60.
Your position is that they can't get sanctions without getting Rule 60B relief first. You have a problem.
We haven't taken a position on that question in this case.
Well, what's the answer? Do you need Rule 60B relief?
I think there are
sanctions.
I think that sanctions aren't limited to Rule 60 in the sanctions in little s. But when one makes a motion before the lower court under Rule 60, then they have to meet the requirements of Rule 60, which we believe haven't been satisfied.
I'm not sure that I understand your answer.
Well, my question.
Do they need to get 60B relief in order to move for sanctions?
In any other case, generally people don't need to move under Rule 60 to move the lower court for a sanctions relief, if that's the question, Your Honor.
Okay.
In here, the problem with even moving for sanctions is that the findings of the special master in the trial court with respect to the Rule 60, and ultimately it's more simply than that the court below relied upon the testimony. It goes beyond that to the point where it was clearly there's no evidence at all.
I don't understand the latter part of your answer. I mean, if they don't have to move to set aside the judgment under Rule 60B to move for sanctions, they have a problem because they didn't move for sanctions.
They have a problem right now, Your Honor, because this court does not have a motion for sanctions before it. Neither did the trial court below. So what this court says about a motion for sanctions, in our view, is completely advisory. What this court has before it is a motion for Rule 60 relief. And as we explain in our papers, we don't believe that
But it would be appropriate if you had to get the Rule 60B relief in order to move for sanctions.
Right. We didn't understand that was I'm not in a position here to say that that's required. And my initial reaction would be, I don't think that you need to move under Rule 60 to seek sanctions. But anyway, so that takes care of accidentally the Rule 60 discussion, which I'm not going to repeat our briefs, but I think it's pretty clear that we think that the determination by the special master and the trial court on Rule 60 was proper. I would just highlight again a comment earlier. We don't see an explanation at all for the damages in this case. And I want to say one last thing about, I should actually back up, one last thing about the ATF orders. And that is, we do believe that they're not incorporated under this contract, but we also don't believe they were violated here. The ATF orders with respect to the fire relate to the ATF orders 3040.2 and 2A, which came after the settlement agreement. And basically, the bottom line with those orders is, if there's a threat, a credible threat to an agent, the agency will take various steps to make sure that that agent is protected. And the most serious of those steps would be to move the agent. And after the fire here, Mr. Dobbins was asked to move by the ATF, and APPX 393 to 95, and he turned them down because he wanted to stay in Tucson. So we don't think there's even a violation there.
Yes, Your Honor. As you say, your time has ended.
Okay. Well, my last comment then is the best characterization from the agency on the credentials question could be found at Mr. Vidoli's testimony at APPX 15264. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hawking. Mr. Reed, there's a little rebuttal time on the cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to really focus on what we're asking for procedurally with respect to the proceedings, because I think if we're not careful, we'll reach an outcome that, Judge Dyke, you're actually wanting to protect us against. We are not cross appealing now for additor of the damages. We are not cross appealing to set aside the findings in terms of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. We are trying to offer the court an additional independent and sufficient ground to rely upon. But with respect to Rule 60, all we wanted to do was to replicate the remand order from 4 years ago. Now, that remand order was very cautious and very careful and very thoughtful regarding Judge Legra's indicative ruling. And it made very clear in the remand order that we're not opening up anything else. We're not going to the merits on this. We're not setting aside the 173. We are simply restoring jurisdiction to the trial court for enough time to take a look at what happened, and very particularly to take a look based on footnote 25 of the trial court opinion, when there was actually a counsel of record from ATF who contacted the Phoenix SAC Thomas Atterbury and tried to get him not to reopen the arson investigation. Those kinds of things were going on. Judge Allegra wanted us to find out what was going on, and then, as the case law we put in our brief indicates, once it's opened up, once we have the facts to support a sanctions motion, and I would never think of filing a sanctions motion unless I had the preliminary facts first. I would never take the court's time on that, and I take sanctions motions very seriously. That was the reason that Judge Allegra had let us precede any kind of motion like that with discovery, with some depositions, with an evidentiary hearing. At that point, then we would know the remedy that was appropriate. We don't know that remedy yet. What we don't want the court to do, and what we ask that the court not do, is open up the entire proceeding and send it back down to the trial court with us no longer tragically having Judge Allegra there with familiarity with the record, knowing what he would do with it. We've simply lost that. And at that point, Mr. Dobbins and I we locked down the case in chief. So unless this court can determine that you can send us back down in a limited way just to look at the misconduct and see if sanctions or EJA grounds are available, then we simply don't want to go back down there. And I thank the court for your deliberation.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.